Money is our theme. It's kind of amazing to hear that coin going around and around. Stephen Mayne, who's the founder of crikey.com.au and a shareholder activist. Stephen, good morning. We're talking money. Lots on lots of different fronts this morning on Mornings, and you're always in the money business.
Well, yes, I am, and this week in particular will be most interesting because we have the release of the BLW Rich List for 2008 on Thursday.
So, no prizes for guessing who's on top.
Well, a very different man, Andrew Forrest, the Fortescue Metals founder. His stake in Fortescue cracked $10 billion yesterday for the first time when Fortescue Metals shares rose 34 cents to $9.90, and it's really quite hard to believe that he's going to be double the wealth of people like Frank Lowy and Dick Pratt, and almost double James Packer when we see the figures on Thursday, because Fortescue Metals shares just continue to go up, up, and up, and the company's now worth about $27 billion.
So he's worth, you reckon, $10 billion.
Well, his stake alone, the value of his stake alone cracked $10 billion yesterday. He's spent only, you know, barely $100 million buying it, because literally he founded the company and, you know, bought his stake for a song, issued shares to other companies and other investors, particularly offshore investors, and then just watched it go into the stratosphere. I think what will also be interesting is that I think the second, well, in my view, and I do my own rich list as well, but my view, the second richest Australian now is actually Gina Rinehart, who Lang Hancock's daughter, who inherited all those wonderful royalty deals on iron ore in the Pilbara and is co-developing big iron ore mines such as Hope Downs with Rio Tinto. BLW said she was worth $4 billion last year, and they were predicting then that if anyone was going to top James Packer, it would be Gina Rinehart. So I think she'll be sort of she should be $7-8 billion this year, given that Hope Downs and other mines are being cranked up as part of this whole BHP and Rio Tinto takeover battle. So I think you'll see two iron ore moguls, one who inherited the wealth and the other who was cannily enough bought into it, sitting at 1 and 2 on Australia, which is appropriate given that we are, you know, a great mining nation and we're in the middle of an unprecedented resources boom.
Well, let's drill down a bit further into that idea. Does that mean that the entire rich list will be dominated by people who are either miners or related to them?
I don't think that dominated, but we'll certainly see new mining billionaires, people like Ken Talbot from MacArthur Coal and Tony Polley from Aquila Resources. They'll be declared new mining billionaires. And then, I mean, I have a rich list of 1,000 Australians worth more than $10 million, and it's certainly well over 100 on my list are people who, you know, mining players. There's an awful lot of chief executives and directors of mid-level mining companies. I mean, yesterday, Felix Resources is a coal miner. Its shares went up to $21 yesterday. You know, 18 months ago, they were $4. And they will have 4 or 5 representatives on the rich list and another, you know, almost close to 10 sort of executives and directors and managers and early backers who have certainly put together wealth worth more than $10 million. So there'll be a large number of them, but I always have a tinge of regret when you look at this, Deborah, because you know, Australians only own about 20% of our resource projects, and the real wealth from this current resources boom has gone to the likes of Mitsui, Mitsubishi, Anglo-American, Xstrata, Chevron, BP, Shell, all these major global mining houses who, you know, control 90% of the Northwest Shelf, all the mines in Mount Isa, the super pit in Kalgoorlie. So those that are left in Australian hands, certainly there'll be a lot of people flying up the rich list. But, you know, it is ironic that you get the projects like the Northwest Shelf now throwing off profits of close to $10 billion a year, and the Australian component of that is, 10%.
Now, Stephen, just for interest's sake, there's another top of the pops that I love, which is the top 100 taxpayers. Will these people also appear in that list?
Well, I must admit, you don't see too much coverage on the top 100 taxpayers. But, look, I think, James Packer, you know, Kerry used to ultimately have his holding company in a tax haven. I think it was the Bahamas or Bermuda. But look, PBL Media or Consolidated Media Holdings, it pays fully franked dividends, and so does Crown, the casino interests for the Packers are Crown. So I think you'll see that they are paying hundreds of millions of dollars a year in tax. Frank Lowy's Westfield Group, they're making a lot of money. They're making more than $1 billion a year globally, so they'll be paying a fair whack of tax. I mean, Rupert Murdoch's a bit more aggressive. His personal shareholding in News Corp is traded on the Bermuda Stock Exchange, but News Limited still, obviously, when it makes profits in Australia, does pay it. But look, like anyone who's rich, they push the envelope a bit on the tax front and try not to pay a dollar more than they have to. What was the famous Kerry Packer quote about you have to have your head red if you pay a cent more than you have to with the way the politicians spend it? So, I think there's a bit of a crackdown going on with the ATO on high net worth individuals. So I think there's not as much tax rorting going on perhaps as there used to be.
Now, the Westfield AGM was Friday.
Well, that's right. When the loss of Kerry Packer and Rupert Murdoch's move to America, you don't have too many legendary billionaires who you can take on at an AGM these days. So Frank is the last great mega billionaire left standing. And we had his AGM in Sydney on Friday, and he was at his combative best. I got up and said, look, Frank, you don't have any debt on your $3 billion worth of Westfield shares, as you've just told the shareholders. You're receiving dividends of about $180 million a year. Does the family, you and your two boys, really need to be drawing salary of $35 million a year? I mean, why don't you do a James Packer and offer your services for free to the shareholders and to be able to stand up and say, well, we're not double dipping? And he gave a very passionate response about if you work, you should get paid. And I give many, many, many millions more away each year than my $16 million salary. And he got a large round of applause after he gave that speech. And he did say to the shareholders, thank you for the applause. I do like it. Who doesn't? And I think he felt quite reaffirmed in his policy of, yes, he does have the highest salary in the country, apart from Macquarie Bank. But he's delivered over the long term for shareholders. And I said to Frank, look, Frank, we've all taken a bit of a haircut this year on our shares. The shares are down 20%. Why don't you take a haircut on your salary? And he said, well, my haircut's been bigger than yours because I own more shares and you only own 3 shares. And I think I deserve to get paid, and I give all this money away. And I think basically the shareholders defended him. So at 77, he's still getting paid a huge whack. He committed to serve a full term. He's going to go executive chairman until he's 80, and I'll make a prediction here, Deborah, that I think that when he turns 80 2011 or 2010, he'll have just knocked up 50 years running Westfield. I think that will be the time when he steps back and becomes non-executive chairman, earning perhaps a humble million a year rather than struggling along on 16.
That's when they'll give him the stainless steel watch.
I think that's right, yes.
Now, of course, it's very interesting to see the fortunes of various football clubs as they come and go and various high flyers that go with them. Rugby internationals have always had a special place in our hearts as business followers.
Well, that's right. I think particularly the Sydney rugby internationals or those coming out of New Zealand, they often tend to do quite well in business. And as of yesterday or last week, we had two former rugby internationals running our top 100 companies in Mike Hawker at IAG, the old NRMA Insurance, and David Kirk, the former All Blacks captain, who is the chief executive of Fairfax. But unfortunately, we're down to one now because Mike Hawker fell on his sword yesterday and admitted that he'd lost the support of the coach and the fans, and he's bowed out. And IAG, which is under enormous pressure for having rejected the QBE takeover, has appointed Mike Wilkins from Promina, and James Strong, the chairman with the bow ties, and the former Qantas CEO, he's also under a fair bit of pressure as the chairman who's been there for 7 years. Often you find in these situations that CEOs and chairs do tend to go together. There's a long history of companies, whether it's Westpac or NAB or BHP, when they've lost the faith of their shareholders, they've had a CEO and a chairman who've both been there together for a long time, they tend to go within quick succession. So I wouldn't be surprised if James Strong followed Mike Hawker out the door in the next 6 months or so.
And David Kirk, of course, the other day was subject of a feature, I think it was in the Financial Review, and there seemed to be, well, he was saying he's not going anywhere at Fairfax, but there does seem to be some brittleness or at least some, sorting out the relationship between he and the others at the top there.
Well, that's right. Mr. McCarthy, the Rural Press CEO, he's a chief operating officer, and he was quoted saying, well, it is a bit frustrating not making all the decisions. And so it's like with any marriage and merger, you try and accommodate the two CEOs at the top. And it's often a very difficult situation. At BHP Billiton, Paul Anderson got terminated a year early, so Brian Gilbertson from Billiton could take over, and he got fired after 6 months. So there's not many examples of a big merger happening and the two CEOs both staying on as top executives for a period of time. Fairfax have now done it for a bit over a year. David Kirk, the All Blacks former captain, he's soldiering on with the big picture approach, and his deputy is chief operating officer, and the share price has come off 30-40% almost from the peak. So I think Fairfax is under a bit of pressure, and having the two captains in there, Captain Kirk and his mate, maybe it's not sustainable in the longer term.
Now with us is Stephen Mayne. He's the founder of Crikey.com.au. He's a shareholder activist. He's watching the moves down in Tasmania, the ANZ decision not to finance the Gunns paper mill. Gee, that was an interesting move, Stephen.
Yeah, very interesting, because it's still yet to be formally announced. But ANZ is privately telling relevant stakeholders, such as opponents of the mill and Gunns itself, that they've decided they won't fund the mill. And Gunns has been banked by ANZ since 1995. And John Gay, the head of Gunns, was saying ANZ is organising the syndicate, a big team of international banks, and the financing will be just fine. And now we've had ANZ basically privately saying they've decided not to do it, and I think it's partly a PR move because they've suffered such flack over the whole Opus Prime fiasco that they're out there saying things like, oh, we're not going to have our ads appear on the footy show because of Sam Newman's outrageous antics, which is sort of a bit of a PR move as well, and we're not going to get involved with Gunns in financing their mill. So ANZ's a bit gun shy, pardon the pun, to get into any controversial situations. They're trying to rebuild their brand after Opus. So and with old Paul Lennon quitting as the Premier, and he was just so favourable in favour of the mill, I think there's probably a balance of probabilities the mill won't go ahead, because the new Tasmanian Premier, David Bartlett, yesterday said he's never even met the Gunns CEO, John Gay, whereas Mark Latham famously said that John Gay runs Tasmania, and I think the quote was old Lennon wouldn't scratch himself if John Gay didn't say to do so, was the famous Mark Latham description of the situation in Tasmania. So things are certainly changing in Tassie. And another prediction for you, Deborah, I think the mill actually won't proceed, and the global credit crunch and just the odium around it means it won't get the finance required to build it.
Well, I think it was always really hinging on money at a particular price. If the interest rate moved against Gunns, that mill was always going to be in trouble.
Well, I think that's right. And the other issue is that you have a company which is worth $1.2 billion, trying to build a $2 billion mill. Now, I can't think of, apart from mining startups like Fortescue, for instance, which was trying to build a $3, $4 billion mines when it was only worth $300 or $400 million at the start, then they went out and raised equity. So you issue shares and you raise equity and you get finance and you do your project. Now, Gunns hasn't actually gone out and raised any new equity, so the balance sheet is too small. They actually have to have a share issue to beef up their balance sheet before they can do a proper debt issue. And their shares have fallen 10% in the last 3 days since the reports first started coming out about ANZ's decision. And then with Lennon quitting yesterday, the shares fell another 3%. And I think, with this global credit crunch and this new responsible investing, ethical investing, the United Nations principle of responsible investing and these so-called equator principles where all these global banks sign up to sustainability and these sorts of things, that it is quite difficult to justify the pulp mill when you have those sort of considerations, plus with a global credit crunch and all the political heat that follows. And, the pulp mill is a bit like the Middle East down there in Tasmania. It really splits the community. So I've got a feeling that it's not going to go ahead. And once that decision's made, then, of course, you get the long-term question about old-growth logging, because you can't really justify old-growth logging if you're just going to send the chips offshore. You can justify it if you've got a long-term mill project and you're actually value adding. So once you take away the mill, then you get back to the whole debate about old growth logging, which I think we'll see happen.
Stephen, one more quick question. Macquarie Bank, of course, delivered those tremendous salary packages to executives. The ANZ Bank has made these decisions to not proceed with this controversial decision in Tasmania to back this miller, back this timber company. One of our spin doctors here last week said Macquarie Bank just basically had to get the whacks that were coming to it and things would calm down. Now, is it as easy as all of that for a bank to clean up its act? Just hold your hand out, take the cuts, and then get on with business.
Well, I had a go at John McFarlane, the former ANZ chief executive who was up for election at the Westfield AGM on Friday, and I sort of said, you know, we should vote against you because of Opus Prime, because it's been a fiasco. And he came up to me afterwards and told me I was out of order and that he'd created $40 billion of shareholder value over his 10 years running ANZ, and Opus Prime wasn't material. And I think that is actually right in the case of ANZ, that Australia's got a lucrative banking cartel, we've got the world's most expensive banking system, all the banks are making a fortune, just an ANZ has, and whether ANZ does or doesn't fund the mill and Opus Prime, it's not material, they're still making a fortune. In the case of Macquarie Bank, I think it's a bit different because their model relies on ripping out huge fees from third-party listed funds. But all those funds are now trading at up to 30 and 40% discounts to the claim value of the assets. So Macquarie Airports, they claim Sydney Airport's worth close to $12 billion. And Maxmore Wilton, the chairman of Macquarie Airports, claimed at the AGM last Thursday that he could sell it for substantially more. And the market just doesn't believe him. And the market is sick of all these huge fees being ripped out by the likes of Macquarie and Babcock and Brown. So I think that the ANZ and the big bank model is fine. They'll continue to make a fortune unless the regulators and the Rudd government really decide to clamp down on all those outrageous fees. That's the biggest risk for our banks. With Macquarie and Babcock and all the financial engineers, I think it's different and their model isn't really sustainable in the longer term. I think you will see the salaries coming off a bit and the share price coming off a bit because they can't just keep on doing what they've been doing in the past.
Stephen, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thanks, Deborah.